Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan on News Talk.
Now, just before I introduce my first guest, just a warning, if you've little ears in the background, this next conversation is of a sensitive nature. So I just want to flag that in advance, because you might have heard this week about a 48-year-old man who was jailed for 8 years for raping and coercively controlling his wife. Sergio Correa, who has an address at Front Street in Ardran, County Donegal, was found guilty by a jury earlier this year, and his former wife, Kathleen, waived her right to anonymity. She spoke out at the court on Monday, and she said that people shouldn't be afraid to speak out if something bad happens behind closed doors in their home. I sat down and spoke with Kathleen just before we came on air today, and I began by asking her to just tell me what it was like waking up in County Sligo this morning, now 2 days on from that sentencing, and how that felt for her personally.
I suppose the main thing I feel is relief that it's all over, as in the legal side of things, because that goes on for a very, very long time. And it's always hanging over you, so there is relief that, you know, it's done, and I can breathe now that, you know, I got through it. And I think, you know, also I'm grateful that justice was served as well. And you know, I think I'm just hopeful that I can, you know, move on with my life now.
Bring us back and tell us a little bit about when you first met Sergio in Portugal in 2006.
Okay, so I went on a holiday in 2006 with a friend of mine. She actually knew of Sergio, and she said, oh, we'll go to the place that he works, and, you know, we'll say hi, and which we did. We ended up meeting a few times, you know, there for a drink and that, and we all got on very well, the three of us. He said that he, you know, he really liked Ireland, and it's very seasonal in Portugal, so he said, you know, once the season ends, he might come over. And that was basically it. A month later, he came to Ireland, and that would have been September, maybe October 2006, yeah. It
was all very normal, run-of-the-mill, Kathleen, at that point?
At that point, yes, I believe it was run-of-the-mill. But, you know, we didn't see each other all that often because, you know, where I worked and where he worked were, you know, there was distance between us, and also I worked Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and he worked different shifts and weekends and stuff. So we didn't see an awful lot of each other, but, you know, when we did meet, you know, I felt everything was okay and normal.
Things progressed. You guys went on to get married.
We did. In 2012 we did. But looking back now, I think, you know, he was so charming, and he'd done all the right things, you know, that it's very easy to get, you know, swept off your feet. And, you know, I suppose it was a different nationality, and, you know, he was a great people person, and he was liked by so many people. And, you know, it was, looking back now, it's easier to look back in hindsight. But yeah, the relationship progressed, and we did get married in 2012.
Look, when did you first start to notice, Kathleen, that, you know, that something just wasn't right? What were those first alarm bells?
I think the first, those real alarm bells were when we had got married. And I kind of noticed a difference in his attitude. And it was more that I was his wife now, and really, like, I belonged, you know, to him. And, you know, he was different, and the way he behaved, and, you know, any issues that might have been going on that I would address with him, you know, he would kind of shut them down all the time. And that was, yeah, that was kind of the start of, you know, where I knew something was wrong. But obviously it was escalating, you know, gradually over time.
And look, I know it's not an easy thing to talk about, Kathleen, and, you know, you can tell us as much as you like about this, but can you tell us a little bit about how things escalated?
I suppose his mood, you know, he was kind of more agitated, and his tolerance for things, you know, wasn't great. I knew that he smoked cannabis I didn't agree with it. I always said it wasn't something that, you know, I ever done, and I, you know, I didn't like the drugs or anything like that. He always said that that was all he ever did, and it was only a little bit, and he tried to say it wasn't a big deal, that, you know, everyone smokes a bit, and, you know, I was making an issue out of something that, that shouldn't be. And, you know, I suppose I kind of left it, but I said, you know, just don't smoke too much of it, or, you know, like, again, I shouldn't have accepted that. But and obviously then his demands for sex in the marriage was, you know, they were very high, and it was always so intense, and he never, I couldn't reason with him. And I tried so many times, you know, to sit down and have a conversation, you know, very calm, you know, an adult conversation, to explain that, you know, what he expects or thinks that should happen is not normal, and that, you know, married couples or couples in general, and, you know, are busy and have children and working, you know, they, people don't schedule, you know, sex in, and it doesn't have to be 5 times a week, or it doesn't have to be anything, you know. And I tried to, because that's what he expected. And, you know, the more conversations I had with him about it, he wouldn't accept that. And he said, you know, I'd say about maybe other couples or anyone that I know, like, that's not, and he just said, I don't care what other couples are doing or what's happening in their house, but this is what's happening in our house, and I won't put up with anything less. And I was, you know, I didn't know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But is it like this in other houses? I don't know. I'm not going to ask people, you know. But
yeah.
And he said there was something wrong with me. There's, you know, there's something, I'm not, you know, I wasn't a proper wife. And, you know, when you're, I suppose, and I was at the time, I was at home minding my children. I wasn't working because the kids were small, and I just stayed home because my eldest son had medical problems. And, like, I just felt so isolated, and thinking, I don't know, could I say it to somebody? Could I ask somebody? But, you know, I always, you know, hoped that it would get better, or he'd eventually realise, or, you know, maybe if I have another conversation with him, you know. And I did tell him how much it was affecting me, and I was really struggling with it, but, you know, he didn't care.
I heard you say, and even listening, you know, to you outside the court on Monday, Kathleen, and reading your victim impact statement, I heard you mention that no never meant no.
Oh, no. No never meant no for Sergio. And no matter how many times I said it, didn't matter whether I was sick or tired or, you know, just had a bad day. It was always, you know, what he wanted. And, you know, like that, if he ended up leaving you alone, or that's what he'd say, I'll leave you alone tonight. And, you know, I would be so relieved, you know, that I was left alone. But he would remind me of that the next morning. He was like, you got away last night, but he said, you won't get away tonight. And, you know, it was that constant fear and the dread of, my God, what am I going to do? And, you know, how am I going to get through the day? And it was on my mind all day. But then I was just trying to do the normal things and mind the kids and cook the dinner and, you know, just do normal
washing
stuff.
Washing and all the usual stuff.
I was dreading what was coming. And, you know, I knew that it didn't matter if I said no, and I'd be relieved if, you know, if I was left alone for a night, you know. But I'd still know that, well, I was left alone tonight. I'd be dreading the next night, you know, because I knew I wouldn't get 2 nights in a row, you know, that kind of way. And it's just a, you know, terrible fear.
Sounds like a constant,
constant
state of fear, Kathleen. Look, I don't want to pry too much, but when did it reach its worst point, Kathleen?
You know, I suppose, as I said, from 2012, that was kind of gradually getting more. And I suppose I was starting to say it to him more often, trying to reason with him, trying to say, you know, please, can you just, you know, can you not put me under so much pressure all the time? And this is something that shouldn't be scheduled. And I tried to, you know, but the more I was trying to go against what he wanted, he was getting more, you know, agitated and annoyed with me that I was even trying to reason with him. You know, it was his way or no way, you know. So I think gradually it just kind of kept getting worse and worse, and he wanted more things, and he was pushing more boundaries. And, you know, it would be last night, you know, you were great last night, and, you know, the same tonight now, but just a little bit extra, an extra treat for your husband, or, you know, and I just like, what's the extra? You know, what's coming? Like, what am I going to have to do? And it was, you know, it was like that all the time up until 2018. We did decide to move to Portugal. You know, together we discussed it. Obviously, we had concerns, and we hoped that it would work out. Both of us did, but you know, we made the decision to move there. I was hopeful that I thought maybe if we go, you know, to his home place and his family are around and he has his friends, and maybe he'll be different then, you know, and maybe he won't want to act like this, or, you know, something might change if we moved there. And I hoped that that would work, but for a lot of reasons, you know, it didn't work out, and you know, school system and things, but I don't need to get into that. But we did decide, we chose that, you know, it's not going to work, and you know, we have to move back. And we did in 2019. Yeah. We moved back in January, and it was really, really bad when we moved back in 2019. It's as if he blamed me that we moved to Portugal, and that, you know, obviously a move is expensive, and we came back and we kind of have to restart our lives all over again. And, you know, it was hard. It was very hard. And, you know, I knew he was blaming me and he was angry about it. And, you know, I said to him, like, you can't spend the rest of our lives being angry because we made a decision that, you know, didn't work out. Loads of people make choices and things don't work out. But, you know, we just have to pick up and move on, you know, what we have to do, because I've been angry. And I said it was a joint decision, but he was so angry, and he knew that he was smoking cannabis a lot. And I said, you know, I kept asking him what he was to stop, but he wouldn't. And, you know, he was very, very angry towards me, and I was walking on eggshells in the house. And he obviously, his control and demand for sex was really intense. That year, it just totally broke me. I don't know how I survived in that year. And I suppose things came to a head then in July in 2019, when I brought him to the Gibson Hotel for his birthday. And
this was a sort of a treat, Kathleen, that, you know, you'd it all planned out for him, night away for a concert.
Exactly, because he was Eddie Vedder. It was his favourite singer. He's from a band, Pearl Jam. And, you know, I thought he was so angry and so unhappy. And when I seen this coming up, that this concert was coming, and it was in July, and his birthday was in July, I thought, you know, I'll buy him the ticket, and he'll have something to look forward to. And, you know, it might make him feel less, you know, angry, or, you know, just something for us both to look forward to. And I told him about it when I booked the ticket, because it was a few months before that, maybe in February I bought the ticket, and I told him just so he could book the time off work. And I remember that day he came home from work, and he said, oh, that's great, I can't wait for that, you know, I'll get anal that night. And I just couldn't explain how I felt. And I just said, please, Sergio, I don't want to do that. I've said that so many times. And I said, I can't do that. And, you know, for a lot of reasons, but medically, you know, for myself, I couldn't do it. You know, I had a surgery on my bowel in 2006, and, you know, I really don't want that, and I can't do that. And, you know, he didn't answer me or say anything, but I was hoping that, okay, this is a few months away, and, you know, he'll realise and it'll be okay. So I suppose then we went to the concert, and, you know, he expected his birthday treat, and it didn't matter. I said no, and I begged him. I said, please don't do it, because it's really going to hurt, and I'm afraid. And he said that I had to be a proper wife and treat your husband. And so basically he raped me anally that night, and I couldn't understand what had just happened, and, you know, why would he do that to me? you know, how somebody that's, you know, supposed to love you. Sorry.
Take your time, Kathleen.
I said, how could he do that to me? And, you know, I got off the bed. I went to the room, or the bathroom, and I was shaking. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know could I ring somebody, or I didn't know what had happened. I was in a state of shock. I was traumatized. I felt terrible, and I couldn't even articulate. You know, I didn't know what to say, and I stayed there for a while. It felt like a long time. But I remember staying there because I just thought I didn't want to go out to the room and I don't want to see him. So it could be almost nearly an hour. I'd say I just stayed there. And eventually I went out and he was asleep anyway. And I just cried the rest of the night. And I'm so afraid. I said to myself, I can't live like this anymore. And I'll never, ever going anywhere with this man ever again. And I didn't know what I was going to do. But I knew I have to do something, and that was definitely the worst, that was the turn,
that was the moment, Kathleen, you decided enough was enough, and I can't take anymore.
And about a week later, you know, I told my friend, you know, she's my best friend, I said it to her, I said, I didn't know how I was going to say it. I burst out crying, and I was like, you know, I'm not happy. And I basically told her what happened at the Gibson Hotel. And I said, you know, that's just one thing. This is going on for years, and this is what everyday life is like. And, you know, the poor woman, she couldn't believe it. You know, she was in shock, and she was very upset. And, you know, she said to me, Kathleen, that's an abusive marriage, and it's rape. You know, whether he's your husband or not, he can't do it. Like, I couldn't believe it, you know. And I did, you know, say it to my husband, you know, afterwards. I said in July, I said, you know, what you did that night was so, so wrong and so bad. And he did apologize for it. He said, you know, I'm sorry, you know, I shouldn't have done it. And I was like, but I said, you'll do it again, because you keep doing things like this all of the time. And then I suppose it came out then about he said he was taking too many drugs and he had no control over it. And I said, well, that's an issue you have to deal with. And, you know, that's one thing that has to be dealt with. But the main problem here is the way that you're treating me. You know, I can't live like this. And anyway, he proceeded then that he went to a treatment centre and treatment for his addiction.
We'll now hear from Kathleen about when she made the decision to go and report what happened to the Gardaí.
Decided to go to the guards. I was attending a counsellor myself, and you know, I remember he was very concerned for my safety at the time. You know, he was thinking, because I was getting a lot of messages from Sergio, and they were very, you know, anger fueled, and he was looking for things out of the house. And because at that point I had got him to move out of the house, because even though he'd done a treatment centre, you know, he came back to the house after that and he didn't change. And,
yeah, things weren't,
you know, no matter what I said, you know, even though they had told him in the treatment centre, you know, you have to go home and you leave your wife alone, you know, you have to leave her alone. But he didn't hear that, and he didn't care what anyone said. And, you know, it was nearly like, I don't know, it nearly turned into a game for him then. But he, you know, he could keep pushing. And like he always said, you know, you'll never get me out, or you'll never leave me, because you don't want the children to come from a broken home. And, you know, you don't want that for them, because, you know, that's what happened for you. And he kind of used that as a threat over me, because he knew, like, when I got married, I wanted, like everyone gets married, and they want it to last, and they have this, you know, dream that they want it. Like, and, you know, marriage is ups and downs, and there's going to be challenges, but, you know, you're a team, and you're going to work together. And, you know, he just had, that's what I wanted. And, you know, he thought he could do anything, and I would never, you know, when I was very vulnerable, and I wasn't able to stand up to him, so he never thought I would stand up to him. And I suppose my counsellor did advise me that it was the best thing I could do is to go to the local Garda station just to inform them of the messages he was sending me, because he was threatening he was going to come to the house and he was going to take things that were his and jewellery that he bought me and, you know, stuff like that. And I knew, or I had a sense, that he might be back taking drugs. I wasn't sure, but I had a sense that he was. So I was very nervous because I thought if he'd taken drugs, I don't know what he could do.
What he could do.
I'm living on my own and I don't know, you know, so it was my counsellor that advised me to do that.
I went to
the local Garda station and I said, you know, what was happening. My friend, she came with me and, you know, she actually helped me to say what I needed to say because I was so broken. I was a shell of a person at that stage. And basically that man, the guard, he was so kind and he was so nice and just said, like, you know, I really think you need to speak to someone in the DPSU unit. And we didn't know what that was about or never heard anything of it. And he explained what it is, but he said, you know, he's going to contact them and, you know, make a referral and that, you know, they'll be in touch with me. And, you know, I just said, I don't want any trouble. You know, I don't want him to get into any trouble. I was so afraid at the time. But anyway, then after that, then I met with the detectives in the DPSU unit. And
they were really supportive, Kathleen, to you in going through this.
Absolutely, they were absolutely wonderful.
Because I think that's
so
a point worth making, you know, for anybody else listening. Like, it must be a very hard step. And I can imagine that must be a real deterrent for other people to have the courage to go through that first initial meeting, to make contact with the guards. And often, particularly if it's, you know, maybe in a small area or a small station or one or two guards, you know, locally. But that is a hard thing to do. But you found great support in that.
Oh, absolutely. And even just the fact of going there and they sat and they listened to everything that you said, but they believed me. They believed everything I was saying and they could see, you know, how vulnerable I was. And I was broken at that time myself as a person. And, you know, they supported me and they treated me so well and they were so empathetic and, you know, I was treated with dignity, you know, and respect, because it's very difficult.
Very difficult.
Talking about things that are very private. But at no point did I feel uncomfortable and or rushed. And they took so much time with me. And I can't, it means so much at a time when you're at your lowest. And if for someone to listen and to believe what you're saying, after so many years of doubting yourself and thinking it was me that's wrong because he told me it was me that was wrong. There was a cloud, you know, lifting out of my mind.
Well, I think that's a great comfort for anybody listening today that maybe, you know, wants to go forward or maybe your story resonates with them, Kathleen, and they feel in a similar position that they, you know, they know that there was that support network there for you. Obviously, going through the courts process was very difficult. The case was heard earlier this year. The sentencing came on Monday. How did you feel on Monday when you heard the judge deliver the sentence, Kathleen, for 8 years for rape and coercive control?
I think, you know, again, it was just relief. You know, I made it through the system, you know, because it's a very daunting system, the legal system, and you know, you're totally out of your comfort zone because you don't know anything about what's going on. And, you know, I had read cases before. I had, you know, read people how they said that it's very difficult to go through a trial. And, you know, and it is absolutely horrendous. And there's no doubt about that. But when you're anticipating how you're going to survive it, are you going to have the strength and the courage to do it? And, like, it was just relief. You know, relief that I had got there, but like that, I didn't get there on my own. I had so much support, and obviously the DPSU, they were with me from day one and supported me throughout at every stage, you know. And then I had my friends and my family, you know, I wasn't on my own. And, you know, I think that it was never for me about a sentence. In my mind, I said, you know, I didn't have a number in my head. I just hoped that he would be held accountable because he blamed me for so long and I ended up thinking it was my fault. for some reason I wasn't adequate in some way, or I wasn't a good wife, and I was trying to be better. And I just now I know, like, the truth is that, you know, I was a good wife.
Yeah.
And I tried so hard, you know, and I think that, you know, he's going to serve his sentence, and justice has been done. You know, it's been a very long journey and very difficult.
Very, and I imagine it's very emotionally difficult for you, Kathleen, and I suppose even a sense of grief as well, you know, through all of this. Like, when you got the sentence on Monday and you heard that and made your victim impact statement, like, you even went a step further. You decided to waive your right to anonymity. Why did you do that, Kathleen?
It's been that for a lot of reasons. The first thing was, I think the last few years have been, you know, horrendous and very lonely and very lonely and isolated, because, you know, because there's a criminal case going on, you know, you can't talk to people, you can't discuss it, you can't, you know, everything has to be, like, I had a select few people that I could just say it to, and I couldn't. So you just literally, and you were, keep a brave face on all the time, as if everything was normal and life was okay. And, you know, sometimes people would ask me about Sergio and what happened, or where has he gone, and why doesn't he see the kids? It's terrible, you know. And, you know, I was trying to make up a story or try and make up reasons why our marriage ended. And I don't know, I didn't owe anybody an explanation, but, I had to say something.
I know.
And it was just chipping away at me all the time that I have to cover this up. And I felt that it was such a burden that I was carrying. I felt so ashamed of what had happened, and felt like, how did I allow this to happen? You know, why did I not, you know, stand up for myself? And it was just so many negative feelings. And I thought to myself, if I can just say it, what happened, and I don't have to feel ashamed about it. And, you know, I think that was the main thing, because I thought, I'll have to live with this for the rest of my life, and nobody will ever know. And then, obviously, I wanted to raise awareness. People, you know, they might not be aware that these things are happening, and unfortunately, they're happening probably more than we think.
We ever know. I thought it was very powerful on Monday when you said that, you know, people shouldn't be afraid to speak out if something bad happens behind closed doors, and they should come forward. I've no doubt, Kathleen, that people listening to your story will feel comfortable and confident to go forward and report incidents like this to the authorities. Particularly, I suppose, seeing, you know, how strong and courageous you were in doing that, and the sentence that was handed down. What does the future hold for you, Kathleen?
Well, I'm not too sure. I just know that it's going to be better than what it has been.
Yeah.
I feel a weight has been lifted.
Good.
You know, I feel like I've been carrying this kind of a cloak on me for so long, and I've been concealing a huge part of my life from everybody, from people, my friends, anyway, from everybody. And it's been very difficult to live with something that's so hard, but not being able to talk about it. And it just, I feel lighter in myself, and that hopefully I just want the simple things. I just want to feel safe, and I want happiness. And, you know, I want me and my children to have a normal life,
yeah,
and do the normal things, in life, and that's it.
I hope you know you've done a great service for so many women. I hope you realise that, Kathleen.
I hope that I will help somebody somewhere, because it's really because I do think back, if I seen something like this or heard a story like that, I'd 100% know it would have helped me so much. You know, because you're so alone and you're so isolated. And it would have comforted me. So I hope that by waiving my anonymity, I will have helped somebody somewhere.
Well, I've no doubt that you have. And I want to thank you very much, Kathleen, for your time today on the programme, because I understand completely this is an extremely difficult, it's a very personal issue for you and and the family and the kids, and I really appreciate you talking to us today, because I have no doubt that you will inspire somebody else in the country to go forward and raise their issue and their complaint and know that they shouldn't have to put up, you know, with that behind closed doors in their home. I wish you all the best for the future, Kathleen.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
Take care of yourself and best of luck to yourself and the family.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Kathleen Correa. What an incredibly brave and courageous woman. Like, we use that word probably too frequently, but I just am absolutely, totally blown away by her courage in telling that story, because it's a very personal, very, very personal, intimate situation and story she found herself in. And I, like, just thinking about how difficult it must have been for her to go and contact the guards and talk about that and the, you know, the bravery to waive her right to anonymity and share that story. If you're still listening, Kathleen, I can tell you, you know, you have really provided help and encouragement to people today, because I have a text from a listener who says, when I'm listening to this lady's story, it's my story with my husband for almost 30 years. And I now realise today that I'm not alone. And if that texter is still listening to us, I suppose if there's anything to take from Kathleen's story today, it's that, you know, in going to the guards and the protective services unit, she had a really good experience, a positive experience. And as Kathleen said herself, she's encouraging other people to come forward. The Women's Aid free phone 24-hour helpline number, I just want to give that out to that listener or anybody else. It's 1800 341 900. The Dublin Rape Crisis Centre's 24-hour helpline is 1800 77 8888, and if anybody feels they're in immediate danger, you can always ring the guards as well. That's on 999. David Finnegan has got in touch. He says, I'm 53 years of age and I have tears rolling down my face. What a brave and wonderful woman. Lorraine has got in contact. She says, Kathleen is just the bravest and most generous woman for telling her horrific story to the public. Her actions will surely help so many other people in time to come. Thank you, Kathleen. I hope you continue to get the care that you now need on the other side of all of this as well. Listener here has got in touch to say, I'm weeping for Kathleen, for all that she's been through, how brave she is, a clean slate, go and live the rest of your life how you choose to. Thank you for telling your story. Many, many women trapped, hopefully hearing your story today, this will give them the courage that they need to just start by confiding in somebody that they trust. Kate has got in contact as well. She says that lady is just so brave about her experience. I hope other women and men who are suffering like this will find the strength to leave. Lots of people have nowhere to go, or maybe they're just not in a financial position to leave, but my heart absolutely goes out to that woman. And that's from Kate. And another listener has got in contact too, Kathleen, and she says, as somebody in recovery myself, I just want to thank Kathleen for telling her story today.
Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan. Weekdays at midday on News Talk.